Hi, it's Michael Senoff with MichaelSenoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called Campaigns, Case Studies in Cold Hard Cash. This is part two interview with legendary list broker Michael Fishman. For more than 25 years, Michael Fishman has played an instrumental part in hundreds of direct mail campaigns and product launches. And in this audio, he looks back at some of the best all-time launches and shares the lessons he's learned along the way. According to Michael, the marketplace has been trained over the years to accept certain kinds of mailing formats by certain companies and at specific price points. That's why the campaigns of yesterday may not work today. So in this audio, you'll hear Michael analyze the timing, marketplace, format, writing, price, and list of his campaigns to show exactly what makes for a home run then and now. And in addition to analyzing larger products like Rodale's launching of the Doctor's Book of Home Remedies, Michael also shows how smaller mom-and-pop businesses can run research on as little as 150 names to make sure they have successful product launches as well. You'll also learn how to know your marketplace well enough to trust the results of your test and pinpoint where your problems are. You'll also learn all about the different formats in direct mail pieces, magalogs, component pieces, business reply cards, lift pieces, etc., and how to know when to use what. You'll learn the dangers and benefits of bill me later soft offers. You'll learn the difference between a product-driven approach and a market-driven approach, and how to make sure you're not just falling in love with a product that your market won't care about. You'll learn how to find new lists and customers based on similarities in copywriting styles, voice, and headlines. You'll learn all about headlines, how to make sure you're not being too narrow or specific, the three C's to a perfect headline, credibility, community, and current events, and testing to know what works. You'll also learn why you'll want to segment your list when you run tests and launches, and ways to do that. According to Michael, if you validate your product before you bring it to market, you'll always be able to trust your research and your results, no matter how big or small your campaign is. And in this audio interview, you'll hear all about that, along with some tips and tricks on making every mailing campaign a home run. Now let's get going. Come to me with some good case studies from your career. Tell me how you came up with these case studies. Did you kind of just think back in your career, different stories that really just stuck out in your mind? How did you come up with these? And then we'll get into
Well, I thought back, and now with about 25 years of results and case studies, hundreds of campaigns, hundreds of product launches, and I looked back for some of the highlights, some of which are the biggest campaigns and success stories I've been involved with, and a few of those are actually historic in nature on any area of direct marketing. And some were successful, not in any historic way, but just really served really, really well to illustrate a particular point.
Okay, great. Well, let's roll into one. What's the first one you came up with?
Well, the first one is from the time of the Gulf War, which I guess is about 1990. And this is Rodale, best known for their flagship brand, Prevention Magazine. They're also well-known right now for Men's Health Magazine. And Rodale, like many of the larger magazine companies, currently has and has had for a very long time a very, very robust ancillary product business, which for them is principally books.
When you say ancillary, you mean other than their main core, which is magazine?
Exactly. Above and beyond the flagship or the core product that they're best known for some magazine and publishing companies, the books actually become bigger revenue and profit contributors than the magazines that they're best known for. And so Rodale has had a very strong book business for, at this point, over 25 years. And so at that time, they had a book called The Doctor's Book of Home Remedies, which is a reference book of natural cures and remedies for consumers. It was really a home run. Jay Leno, early in his tenure on The Tonight Show, mentioned it on the program. It was just one of these things that became bigger than life and, you know, sort of became a phenomenon.
Were they one of the first into the marketplace with the home remedies?
Been around for quite some time. Prevention Magazine itself, I think, dates back into the 40s or 50s. So the concept of home remedies and country remedies and even back to, you know, like old wives' tales and things like that. Natural remedies have been really present in probably every culture in the world for a very long time, and then in mid-20th century in the United States became a very very popular publishing subject or content subject, really spurred on and led by Rodale's Prevention magazine. So it made sense to put the Prevention brand on reference books because Prevention as a for-profit brand has a high degree of trust associated with it, high degree of benevolence, you know, the kinds of things you'd associate with nonprofits or very caring specific doctors. You know, those are the kinds of attributes that the consumer associates with the Prevention brand. So it's a great door opener even into markets of people that have not previously bought health products. Prevention just has that much trust that they're able to engage people with that brand quite readily. So the Doctor's Book of Home Remedies was, in many respects, their first huge direct mail hit, launched in the late 80s and then rolled out with, in some campaigns, as many as 25 million pieces of mail in one campaign.
So when you say some campaigns, and we're talking one book here by Rodale, how do you determine what a campaign is? Is that per mailing or what?
Good question. A campaign sounds like it could be plural mailings, but I'm saying a campaign is a mailing. In that case, it was something like 55 or 60 18-wheeler trucks filled with mail. It was really an amazing achievement, not only in the book business, in the publishing business, and really in all of direct marketing.
Do you know who wrote the copy for the direct mail piece?
The copy was written by Jim Punkry, who still is with us, an active writer today, and universally acknowledged as a member of what we call the A-list of direct response copywriters. So that was probably one of Jim's earlier efforts. He started, and he lived in the Lehigh Valley near Rodale, and I think started as a staff writer there, but certainly has gone on to a very long list of very big achievements, not only for Rodale, but for other direct response marketers as well. The interesting thing was that Rodale had the ability to hold that mailing back when the Gulf War broke out, but Pat Corpora, who was the president of Rodale Books at the time, made the decision to allow the mail to go out.
The full launch?
The full rollout of 24, 25 million names.
It had already been tested.
Had already been tested. That was probably three or four mailings in, you know, the initial test. And that mailing in, I think, January of 90, if I'm not mistaken, surpassed forecast. It did extremely well and certainly stands as one of the most successful campaigns ever at Rodale and certainly ever at any publishing company.
Now, were you involved in all the lists with that campaign?
Right. I was accountable for the list that went into the original test some months before this rollout, and then certainly supporting the product manager at Rodale in planning that rollout campaign and the many lists that were involved, maybe as many as, you know, 70 or 100 lists, and the obviously substantial quantities that came from each one. You know, there were individual list contributors that brought in 700,000 or even in some cases in excess of 1 million names from individual lists that had previously been validated to work and that were now in the rollout.
Well, do you remember what kind of offer it was? Was it a hard offer where they have to send money or send no money now in their bill?
It was what we call a component piece, which means it was an envelope with a letter and a lift note, an order card, and a business reply envelope. Or at that time, it may have been what we call a BRC, just a business reply card, with the name and address of the recipient inkjetted so that not even a pencil or a pen would be required to respond. You would just drop the card in the mail because your name and address were inkjetted on it. So that was a component piece, a jumbo envelope. The offer at that time was probably, you know, the low $20 range plus shipping and handling, billed in three installments. The installment offer in the book business really was modeled after the Bill Me Later offer that had already been well established in the magazine business and remains to this day. And in fact, there were two aspects to it. One was Bill Me, so it's high up like the book Bill Me Later. The second dimension of it was that it was an installment, meaning you could pay in three different payments instead of just everything up front. And in fact, what we've seen in a lot of book businesses over the years is that when the first bill comes, first of three, most people, and by most, I mean 75 to 80% actually pay the full invoice on the first bill. Because the total amount isn't prohibitive for most people to write the check, you know, high 20s or a low $30 range at that time. But in terms of response, to tell someone the book is $32 or versus to say it's three shots of $9 or $10 made a big difference in response performance.
Right. What's the lesson with this mailing that you could relay to the listeners?
There are probably quite a few. I think the biggest one is to have faith in your past results when rolling out. I mean, in this case, Rodale was faced with a really big decision when the Gulf War broke out, the implications of which could be the consumers are distracted. impacted and results would decline because people weren't focused on marketing and buying products. They were focused on security in the country and so forth. In this case, the campaign and the book were a powerful enough combination, and the copy was strong, and all the ducks were lined up in a row, that the dynamics of this campaign were stronger than whatever the offsetting effect was from distraction in the marketplace, and the campaign really soared and did well. So I think lesson number one is have faith in your prior results, but also have a sense of the nuance of the marketplace and whether or not your offer will be, you know, kind of bumped off its past performance by a market distraction. In this case, the market distraction really didn't touch the results for this campaign.
At that time, the early 90s, were Magalogs being tested at that time? And today, do you think that campaign, how do you think it would compete against a Magalog with the same offer and everything, just difference in the format?
That format really could not live very well today. That took place at a time when Magalogs were either in their immediate infancy or maybe not even in any principal rollouts anywhere with the companies that ultimately embraced and pushed them out in big numbers, like what was then Phillips Publishing, now called Healthy Directions, Boardroom, of course, and even Rodale ultimately did wonderful work for scores of products, very high volumes in direct mail acquisition with the Magalog format. So at the time of Doctor's Book of Home Remedies, Magalogs were either like a glimmer in someone's eye or maybe just getting started. But today, a component piece, you know, big sealed envelope like that would have very, very limited mileage going for it.
Why do you think that is?
Well, once again, we have the marketplace now trained over the course of easily 15 or more years on what kinds of formats are mailed by what kinds of companies selling what kinds of offers at what kinds of price points. And so the marketplace has become very comfortable with selling formats that make it easier to understand the product. Magalogs do not have any physical obstacle of engagement, meaning there's no sealed flap. You know, there's no behavioral obstacle. There's no sort of moment of truth where in the envelope world, if the consumer opens the envelope, it's actually a moment of surrender, okay? If they throw it away unopened, they get to feel victorious, like they won, the marketer lost, I didn't open your envelope, you know, haha. So with an envelope, there's always that moment of truth. Will they open it or will they not? The other thing is that envelope contents don't last very long in the home. There's no shelf life in the home. You don't put envelope contents on your coffee table for 3 days. Whereas with a Magalog, that can be with your catalogs and magazines. You hold on to it for a couple of days, and it gets more chances to be read and opened. So envelopes are still used for lots of offers, particularly prestige brands that are well recognized by the marketplace. But in consumer health, the only brands or companies that really use envelopes anymore are what I call the institutionally positioned health newsletters from organizations like Harvard or Cleveland Clinic or Tufts or Mayo, you know, well-respected, philosophically conservative sort of health institutions. But for commercial brands, envelopes have become quite tough to work with.
When they do 25 million pieces, does it go out all at the same time on that?
Well, those went out theoretically all at the same time. Now, did that happen inside of a 24-hour period? I don't remember the logistics or what the physical process was at that time, but that mail was, for all intents and purposes, put into the Postal Service mail stream on one day. Might it have been 36 hours? I guess that's possible. But in essence, it was one event, one mailing event. That is not the end of that product or any product that hits its sort of zenith or its maximum mail. It's kind of like a bell curve where it may not mail at that level again, but all of those lists that worked will generate new transactions in the subsequent months. And then there were other mailings for Doctor's Book of Home Remedies that took advantage of the list that continued to work. Obviously, you know, some of those declined over time. In what we call the one-shot book business, which is a transaction where someone buys a book, but it's not a series or a club. It's just you bought that book, and that's the end of your obligation. Even the best books of all time, among which Doctor's Book of Home Remedies would certainly be included, there's this precious window of opportunity in the marketplace where maybe that book can mail for 2 to 3 years at the very most. And just market dynamics being what they are, and direct mail fatigue for a particular offer being what it is, at some point the book is sort of complete in terms of its direct mail life cycle.
Very interesting. All right, case study number two.
Well, just staying with Rodale for a minute, maybe 7 to 8 years later, they had a book called New Choices in Natural Healing, which was very similar to Doctor's Book of Home Remedies in that it was an A to Z reference book. It was about natural cures, and it was branded with prevention. And it was also one of the largest volume products in sales volume and prospect mail volume that they had ever done. The interesting thing here was that when the book launched first time out in direct mail, there were two creative packages from two different copywriters, two different creative teams, completely different, and both failed pretty spectacularly.
Do you remember who the two creative teams were?
I'll tell you who won in the next mailing.
Now, how big was this mailing compared to the first one?
The first launch where you kind of stick your toe in the water and check out what's happening in the marketplace or if you can validate performance for your book, that might be, you know, 75 to 100,000. And that's just the first, like, toe in the water. Check it out. Just a little launch test.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
All right, so both creative teams did not succeed on their first attempt.
Right, so both creative teams failed. Here's a case where the research that generated this product was so strong, the customer research, the metrics around the acceptance of the title, the descriptive aspects of the book, all of that was so strong, and there were some good internal champions at Rodale for this title based on the great research they had. They commissioned one more writer named Gary Bensavenga to do another creative version. And Gary, of course, one of the best-known copywriters in direct response and widely acknowledged possibly as one of the best ever, if not the best ever. And Gary discussed it at length in his sort of career farewell seminar that he did 3 or 4 years ago, of which there may still be DVDs around that he sold of the program. But he and I discussed it on stage at his seminar at some pretty good length. So he wrote a book-a-log, which is kind of a direct mail jargon for what looks like a little digest size mail piece.
How big?
Oh, goodness, I don't know the dimensions, but I'll say 6x9.
Okay, so it looks like a mini book.
Exactly. The size of Reader's Digest or what TV Guide used to look like.
Totally different look than the Magalog, right? Like the inside, the design layout.
Yeah, it's a little more like a booklet, even though Magalogs give you some specific value, checklists, and some actual content that's valuable. Like Gary Bensavenga said, make the advertising valuable in itself. Very well known for that statement. The book-a-log, as compared to the Magalog, gives even more value because in and of itself it looks to be like a book or a booklet or a pamphlet. The way in which the design is executed really implies value. There was probably a little, you know, on the cover, maybe $1.95 or $2.95, little dollar, you know, as if people were paying for it, just which also implies and reinforces value. But once again, like a Magalog, it didn't have a sealed flap or a tab closing it that would represent an obstacle for the recipient to get into it.
You could just open it.
You could just open it, and no matter where you opened it, you know, you could kind of start on any page, just like an infomercial or a soap opera. You could come in at any time and be engaged, and there'd be calls to action on every single spread like that. There might be as many as 48 or 64 pages.
Had book-a-logs had some success in direct mail, and how mature were the book-a-logs at that time? Are we still in the early 90s?
This is now mid to late 90s. Book-a-logs are out there, established and acknowledged and validated as a format. You know, Magalogs are now firmly established by Rodale and all the original pioneers in the Magalog format, and now Book-a-logs are coming to the attention of some of the major publishers like Rodale, and this one for New Choices in Natural Healing may have been their first one. So the key here, I guess, to wrap this segment up is that believe in your research, believe in your product development process if you have one, and hopefully everybody listening to us now has some way to validate product concepts before they spend money on prototypes and product development and bringing things to market. You know, that's the difference between a product-driven approach or a market-driven approach. Product-driven means we fall in love with a product and decide the market really needs it. And that approach, while it can work, is a lot riskier than asking the market what it wants and giving them what they say they want, which is a market-driven approach. So in this case, they had a strong market-driven product development process. They believed in it. They understand that even the best copywriters can fail. The first two efforts happened to have both failed, but they weren't swayed or discouraged. They went on to a third creative effort and once again hit one of the top two or three home runs of all time, not only at Rodale, but in the entire direct response book business.
Wow. So just to recap, when you're talking about strong research, you're talking about the research that there was a market for this product.
Right. Not just around books or health books, but this book, this title, descriptive language helping people understand the table of contents and the outline of the book, a research process that really portrayed the book as clearly and as completely as possible, and, you know, with specific quantitative survey results that really demonstrated and validated and pointed to a success for this book were it to be developed and launched.
But what pre-research could someone do to determine the strength of the viability of a product to a marketplace other than actual creative and mailing out?
Well, any marketer of any size or scale that has a customer list, and even if your customer list is, you know, 100 people, there really isn't any reason to ever sidestep or overlook this process. Anyone with a customer list can send their customers a note and let them know they're a valued customer. You know, their opinions are very, very important. We want to grow our business to continue to bring you more great products, great experiences, and great solutions. And we'd be very, very grateful if you'd support us in looking at some of these product ideas we have and maybe check off which ones would have promise or value to you. And I just generated that just now. I didn't read that, and I don't recommend anyone copy it. But that's the spirit of the communication, right? That can be done with a small list or even an anecdotal process like a phone survey if you have that kind of relationship with your customers where they're accustomed to hearing from you and they wouldn't mind a phone call, on up to some very large marketers who can do very deep, fairly substantial quantitative analysis around this stuff. But if you can get anecdotal or survey results even from a small list of just a few hundred customers, that will give you some clues and signals to how to go about to what might be next in your product development process.
The previous creative teams, what format did they test compared to Benzavinga's Bookalog?
I think one was a maglog and one was a closed component envelope with the guts inside the envelope, rather the letter, the lift note, the order card, and the reply envelope.
I see. Do you know on the Bookalog offer, did it have that component of the three payments in there like the previous Rodel book?
Absolutely. Bill Me Later, which we call in publishing a soft offer, and an installment setup. The other thing to remember around all of this is that when you give prospects a choice in direct mail, the danger is that they don't make a choice and that you lose the order. So you see very few companies anymore ever giving someone a choice of pay now or bill me later. It's usually one or the other. The more choices you give and the more effort you embed in the process, the more likely you are to lose an order. You know, and this idea of effort is so excruciatingly sensitive, more sensitive than most people could imagine. I mean, if your business reply card is perforated on the vertical side and on the top horizontal edge, so that would be two perfs, the same card, same price, same everything will have a lower response if the perforation has to be torn on two sides than on one. So this idea of effort and making it easy is actually a very, very highly sensitive process, right down to the number of directions somebody has to tear that card to sort of pry it free of whatever is surrounding it.
Right. In that Bookalog, how is that card attached in that mailing? Is it one perforated?
I'm sure it had to be one.
All right, quantify. You said this is one of the biggest wins in direct mail ever. How do you quantify that? How did you describe this campaign?
Well, this book had individual campaigns that were probably close to 20 million names, and in its lifetime of, let's say, maybe 2 years or a little more, mailed over 100 million prospect names.
All right, what's the next case study?
Next is sort of an interesting language device, and to illustrate this, I'm thinking of a boardroom title, and of course, boardroom is a misnomer. They're, at this point, completely a consumer publishing company that a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. Their newsletters are the Bottom Line Personal and a series of newsletters with the Bottom Line brand. They have infomercials on TV with Hugh Downs selling their health books. Years ago, they had a book for consumers called The Big Black Book, which was a book of inside information and, you know, secrets about ways of doing things more effectively. And what we have here in the title Big Black Book, of course, is the alliteration, the triple repeat of the B consonant. And consumers just tend to resonate with alliterative titles and also alliterative language. If you really look and study copy, as I'm sure you do and many of your clients do and listeners do, you'll see alliterations all over the place. It's just an engaging way to speak or certainly to write for marketing purposes. So one of the lists that I asked them to consider at that time was an infomercial list for a product called Passion, Power, and Profit. And they said, well, what's the connection? And I said, well, I think people that have bought a product with an alliteration in the title would be a good bet to buy another product with an alliteration in the title, you know, all other things being satisfactory.
Was that Marshall Silver infomercial?
I think so. You have an awesome memory, Michael.
I've heard of that.
And this is just a fun little example. You know, Big Black Book was certainly a home run product for Boardroom for many years. But this is a fun little example of ways to engage people. I mean, if you put people in a focus group and said, you know, how do you feel about products with alliterations in the title? I don't think you'd get much of an answer, because it operates below the level of what people are conscious of in terms of their choices. But it happens to be a very engaging device, and in this case it certainly worked. So the little sort of mini fun point here is that product titles and marketing language that I think gracefully and eloquently employ alliterations, it's an engaging language device. This is not a direct mail concept. This is certainly not channel specific. This can be demonstrated on the web or on television or anywhere that your clients are marketing.
So ordinarily, let's say it didn't have that alliteration, you is working on the list in that campaign, would an infomercial list, and are infomercial lists something you test when mailing book offers like that? Or was it specifically because of this alliteration?
Great question. Infomercial lists have had a very, very lengthy record of success for direct mail offers, if and only if they're mailed in a Magalog format. Gene Schwartz, the late great copywriter who was a dear friend and really mentor of mine when I was starting, said that Magalogs were like infomercials in print. Once again, you could start at any page. There'd be calls to action anywhere you started. You could kind of get the hang of it even if you didn't start at the beginning. And the thing about mailing Magalogs to infomercial buyers is that Magalogs were virtually always four color, highly kinetic, highly engaging, lots of information and value all over the place, gives a good representation of what the product is like and what the experience of interacting with that product would be like. You know, the Magalogs were just a super format for engaging infomercial people because of their vibrancy, whereas closed envelope formats mailing to TV sources, once again, that obstacle of that sealed flap, not always, but in a tremendous number of cases, proved to be a physical barrier that infomercial people just would not pass. Whereas the ability to open a Magalog just freely from any page and kind of like a no-pressure situation, no moment of truth, like do I open it or do I not open it, Magalogs engage infomercial people extremely well.
All right, so the lesson here and the idea here is consider alliteration as something similar that worked in another campaign as a possibility to test.
Yeah, it's a copy device, and it's also a product naming device that really kind of sparkles and jumps and is just another nuance in the toolkit of ways to engage people.
Yeah, how successful was the Big Black Book campaign? Do you know how large of a mailing it went out to?
Boardroom mailed that for many years, actually longer than the typical 2 to 3 year lifespan of a one-shot book. So they certainly had numerous campaigns that were into substantial seven figures, you know, into the millions.
Well, do you have any idea on this part of it? You know, when you're mailing the Bill Me Later offer, the percentage of people who never end up paying?
Yeah, at the end of the campaign, a good book, if the copy accurately sets expectations with the buyers, such that when the book shows up, it's along the lines of what they expected, the perceived value is there, you know, et cetera, a solid campaign with everything kind of all cylinders firing, you'll be paid for between 85 and 90% of the books you send out.
Without any collection efforts?
Right.
That's pretty
right.
Good.
Now, you may have a billing series, just like in the magazine business, you'll have a billing series. In a billing series, every billing effort needs to pay for itself in terms of recovered revenue. And then when the last bill that can't pay for itself is the one that you don't do, you know, and over time you learn how many billing efforts you can put out there where each one pays for itself. But at the end of the campaign, you're paid for, you know, 85 to 90% of your books, which is a lot better than the magazine business where you'll be paid for maybe 50 or 60% of the magazines that get ordered.
All right, let's move on to another case study. That was great.
Here's another small one, save a couple of really interesting ones for last, but just another interesting one has to do also with language, and in this case the source of the language, which of course is the copywriter. If you have clients who operate in markets where the copywriters tend to write for a bunch of companies in that market category, the interesting thing here is that if you have a particular copywriter writing for you and you know that copywriter has written for another company where that company actually has generated a list that you use, in essence, you're sending your mail piece to a bunch of people who've responded to the same voice. You see that?
Yeah.
So it's very, very powerful. I mean, I remember one instance many, many years ago where my client had a mail piece written by, once again, Jim Punkry, and there was a list that we wanted to use, which wasn't a slam dunk but had some possibilities. But I knew that that list was generated by direct mail efforts that were also written by Jim Punkry.
That's brilliant.
And so for me, that became kind of the X factor, or like the little secret weapon of why that list might get over the top, because those people would be responding to a language style and a voice, and by voice I mean the written word, but the fact that those people would be receiving another piece of mail written by Jim Punkry could sort of be the X factor that would get that list to work.
Right, that's brilliant. And from our previous interview, when we're talking about doing direct mail, how, from your perspective, you're able to increase the universe, and these are some of the ideas to give you a larger universe in a mailing.
Absolutely. The interesting thing, and once again, this may be true in some of the markets where your clients and listeners operate, if there are lists and copywriters where there's just a real tight, intimate market and the writer's writing for a bunch of companies in the space, it's just one other factor of insurance or affinity or a match, if you will, matching your client's offer to the list they're mailing. And, you know, if they can find out that what they've got and the list they're mailing to are both sort of authored by the same writer, that's another little secret that they can put to work in their advantage.
Let me ask you, on the Big Black Book promotion, who wrote that? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but I'm going to guess it may have been Eric Betchel, who still writes today and, you know, was certainly very, very active in the 80s and 90s.
All right, what do you got next?
Here's a pretty big one. And once again, the line between creative strategies and list strategies to me is really blurred. I mean, there are some purely creative strategies and some pure segmentation strategies, but they really go hand in hand. For me, they're dovetailed. This is a concept around headlines. It works in direct mail, but it's not channel specific. It works amazingly well online as well. And this is what I call the three C's. And you could actually tie all three of these into your headline. And the three C's are credibility, community, and current events. Those are important components of any copy, but to the extent that you can, with authenticity, without having it sound phony or contrived, but to the extent that you can bring those concepts into your headlines is a way to make them very, very powerful and a way to, once again, expand your list universe by raising performance and making that many more lists profitable. I can give you an example of this, which is a headline that I recently wrote, in fact, for the top of a web landing page. So the first part of the headline is, there is a diabetes debacle in this country, which really refers to really the epidemic of new diagnoses and new cases of diabetes, and, you know, diabetes is rampant in the country. It's an unfortunate circumstance, but that part of the headline acknowledges a current trend, and if you're diabetic, you obviously have a high identification and a high affinity with that statement. So that's the current event. The credibility is that I credit that statement and the balance of that headline to the CEO of the company that's doing the marketing. So I say, this is from Health Advocate, and the name of the CEO that I'm going to leave out for now. This is from this Health Advocate and his team of hand-assembled doctors. The CEO of the publishing company, while is known to his customers and is a high-touch guy and a warm, fuzzy, very beloved guy to his customers, he's not an MD and he's not a health practitioner. So we want to surround him with others that can be a bridge to this unshakable credibility. And then community, I just come straight out and say, our dear customers are a community of thousands nationwide who are now living the new diabetes reality. So our dear customers are a community of thousands nationwide. There are certain products or services that lend themselves to markets that are very community-oriented. And diabetes and other health concerns, you know, are certainly one. Coin collecting could be one. You could generate a sense of community probably around most things.
Right. Anyone with a list of customers.
Right. Particularly when it's hobbies or personal interests or, you know, investing clubs. Anything that's hobby or interest-oriented lends itself to that idea of community. So credibility, community, and current events are very, very powerful engagement devices.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
All right, give me an example. How would you tie current events into that? Oh, is it already because of the diabetes epidemic?
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
Exactly. So it's really talking about something that is topical, that is current, and that people who are affected have a very high sensitivity and high identification with.
Okay, that's good.
Next one goes back to product titles. A lot of companies with services and products targeted to particular age groups tend to put an age bracket or an age number in their title, like travel for people 50 and beyond. Or health tips for people 60 and over, things like that. The real danger there, once again, this is not channel specific, but certainly holds true in direct mail if people are listening for really direct mail guidance. If you pick the number for your product for, you know, whatever for people 50 and above, if somebody's 78 years old, 50 was a long time ago. And even though they are over 50, they really are not identifying with your product the way you think they are. So the point here is no matter what you're doing, to be very careful about bringing ages into your product titles or your headlines unless you're quite a bit more inclusive than you originally might be thinking. So the 50 and beyond thing or 50 plus could be changed to, you know, 50, 60, 70 and beyond. And so now you're casting a wider net, and even if someone's 82, it's a lot easier for them to identify with 50, 60, 70 and beyond versus 50 plus, which is a number that they felt connected to 30 years ago, but really not for a long time now. And that actually helps in the segmentation that you're doing on lists, you know, where you can now get to people that are between 60 and 69 or 70 and 79. It will help you do more expansive, more in-depth work in your lists and databases into age groups that can identify with the language that you're using.
How about male and female? Would that be the same thing? Have you seen people making mistakes where they're trying to identify a certain sex, where they may be excluding potential qualified prospects or buyers of the opposite sex?
I love the question, and there's actually a very clear list strategy here. Most products that are gender-specific, that could be Men's Health Magazine, or it could be a hunting or fishing offer or something like that. Most offers for men are clear that they're for men. It's clear, and the positioning. Products that are conceived for men are generally, it's pretty clear how they've been conceived. Same for women. But here's the thing. You have lots of gender-neutral products where even though they're gender-neutral, the product and or the marketing copy that's been created to sell the product may, in ways that we cannot envision, do better with men or with women. And the only way to unconceal that behavior or that difference is to split-test gender in your first mailing. So anytime I have a gender-neutral product that appeals to both men and women, as far as we could tell, equally as well, we take at least one or two lists in the very first mailing and split male and female to specifically illustrate any difference in affinity that there might be there that we can't envision in advance. And sometimes you'll find a 10 or 20 or 30% difference in performance that's inexplicable other than the fact that's what the market is telling you. And so then you can actually take that difference and make all your lists work better. It doesn't make just the list you split work better. That is a result that is not a list-specific result, but rather that is the marketplace saying your product and or your selling copy are doing 20% better to men and you select men on all your lists.
What's another interesting list strategy like that, maybe other than gender, that you can do the same thing with?
You know, really interesting in direct mail and list segmentation, and we may have discussed this in the first part of our interview together, but if so, it even bears just brief repeating, and that's this idea of loyalty. A lot of people, and even, you know, sort of seasoned, experienced marketers, think that if they market to, say, a magazine, that the renewals of that magazine will be the best. Or if they market to a catalog buyer list, that the people who've bought multiple times will be the best. And in fact, those repeat transactions on the list you're mailing to do demonstrate what a good direct marketing buyer that person is. But more important than that, it demonstrates that person's loyalty to the company that they are already doing business with. And in fact, that loyalty depresses response. When I take a client to market to a magazine list, and a fairly substantial one, we will always segment the first-year subscribers from the renews because they really are different animals. The first-year subscriber has yet to forge their relationship and their affinity and their commitment to that editorial product. They're much more open to other offers of other editorial products, especially if it's an editorial product in the same subject. Renewals are, by definition, happy where they are. Whatever they subscribed for, whatever they bought for, they got the result, they got the experience, they feel good, they bought again. So if you can wrestle those people into ordering from you, they will be a great buyer for you, but on the first sale, many fewer will respond.
We're taught the opposite. We're always taught that recency and frequency of buyers are sometimes the best people to mail to, when in fact it may not be.
For sure, Michael. Once again, it's not 100% airtight, but recency is seldom sort of refuted. I mean, recency tends to rule almost all the time. So a recent transaction really is predictive of response behavior. But the real key is to get, like, someone who bought in the last month and was a first-time buyer to that other person's company. If they're a new buyer to that company, that means that, by definition, they're willing to consider other new buyer relationships or new companies or new information products. If they're a renewal or a multiple buyer with that other company, once again, there's a loyalty, there's an affinity, they like that company, they're less likely to buy from you. If they do, they'll be loyal and great. But this is why when you market to large magazines or large catalogs, you always segment the first-time buyers from the multiple buyers because they are different animals.
And you've seen some pretty dramatic differences in response.
Yeah, dramatic. By dramatic, that could be, you know, between 15 and 30% different.
Is there any way you've seen to break that loyalty? I mean, what's the best way to break that loyalty if you're mailing to a loyal buyer?
Well, it's the same way you'd raise response to any list. You know, you'd have a lower price, or you'd have a bill me offer or a sweepstakes or something that just jacks up response. Now, you're forfeiting other things in that case, like revenue and lifetime commitment to your business, because the easier you make it for people to come in, the less committed they need to be to come in, and that will show up in their ongoing and lifetime value to your business. I think it's intuitive. If they come in over a high bar, if they could actually get over this high bar that you present, like a high price point or no sweepstakes, no premium, just, you know, a high dollar offer, anybody who can get in over that high bar is a great, committed, long-term customer. I mean, let's take it to its extreme. You have a free offer. People can just come in for free. They don't have to pay anything, which is what most email newsletters are these days. You can amass a great volume of those people, but to get them to convert to transactions is tough. You know, on a percentage basis, not many will migrate to a paid.
You got one more for me?
The last thing, you know, I think sort of pulls together the multiple channels that I think everybody is thinking about these days. I'm sure most of your clients and listeners are on the Internet as well. And Joe Polish and Dan Hollings came up with this concept called bridge gap marketing, which really speaks to the fact that you may advertise in certain channels, but you need people to migrate to other channels to complete their order. And so this is an idea where if you have landing pages where people are either coming from a direct mail offer or from a pay-per-click campaign or even from a billboard or some local retail handouts or whatever, it's very, very powerful to have a video on your landing page and have different landing pages for each source of traffic. So as an example, the landing page where your recipients of your direct mail are going to go to a landing page, and the CEO or a spokesperson for the company will be on that landing page in a video saying, thank you so much for reading our direct mail letter, and we really appreciate you coming to this web page to learn more, just like that. Not only are you acknowledging and appreciating the customer, which is always a good thing, but you're specifically acknowledging exactly what they just did and where they came from to get to the landing page. But once again, they may have originated from your direct mail letter, from a billboard, from a handout in a supermarket. It could be anywhere. But have the URLs in each of those venues be something that is memorable, that the person can sort of remember and readily get to without misspellings, without all kinds of errors and memory loss. But at the same time, have some different landing pages that acknowledge where the person came from, and it's a very, very powerful way to keep people moving in the marketing process to do ultimately what you want them to do.
Last time we talked in the interview, I'd asked you, have there been any good tests in converting people from a direct mail postcard to the web? And I think you were testing some stuff at that time. Have you got any more further insight into that?
The value there for everybody listening is that I did not see that work. It did not work.
Tell me what was tested.
This was a two-sided postcard in the fitness category mailed to a number of, you know, subscription segments from health and fitness magazines. And true to what I just told you, we tested men and women. We tested renewals and first-year subscribers to just see who we could get to move from the receipt of the mail piece over to a landing page.
How big of a postcard was it? Jumbo or just...
No, it was not a jumbo. I'm going to say it was like a 6x9, either 4x6 or 6x9.
And what was the offer? Do you remember?
Yeah, the offer is a downloadable book about fitness methods and workout techniques and so forth.
How many mailed in the test?
About 35,000. It's interesting and also doesn't make sense, and we didn't expect to fail. We knew it was possible because it was not a slam dunk, but it was something that this particular marketer wanted to evaluate so that he could know that it was tried and he didn't have to think about, gee, maybe I'm leaving direct mail on the table and it's this whole huge thing that I'm not doing that could be successful. So he really wanted to evaluate it, and I thought it made sense to evaluate it. And what we found was that the number of people that migrated from the receipt of the postcard over to the landing page was sort of woefully small. So the migration was the number one obstacle. But those people that made it to the landing page bought at an extremely high rate. Of the people that got there, a high percentage converted to purchase, which once again makes sense because if very few people go where you want them to go, that means the people who did go had a very specific commitment and were really strong in their intention and their appeal and their resonance with the benefits that were promised. So it stands to reason that those who were particularly committed made it to the landing page. They converted very, very well, but just not enough of them went there.
That's a great example. So you haven't seen any examples of offline to online with a postcard work or anything on a decent, credible, large level works?
I think we may have acknowledged last time catalog orders are mostly on the web right now. That's pretty standard. Of course, the ISPs are marketing in direct mail, and those transactions are completed on the web. But in the postcard format, I have not seen it. I'm fairly certain there are some out there, and if any of your listeners are interested in communicating or reporting to you, I think it would be a service to both you and me to know what is out there that's working.
All right, this is good. So these are all your case studies?
Those are mine.
All right, these are all great.
I appreciate that very, very much.
What's the best way for anyone who wants to contact you?
The firm that I'm at is Specialist Marketing Services in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, and the phone here is 201-865-5800.
Okay, and so they can call you, and then you'll set up a time, and you'll talk about, I guess, their needs and just go from there.
Sure. I've been very fortunate to have, you know, done a good amount of speaking, and I'm fairly visible on Twitter and places like that. There's certainly more folks calling. I wish I could help everybody. I know we people in this business tend to be so purpose-driven, and we want to help, help, help. I wish I could help everybody, but I can't. But, you know, I certainly invite anybody to call, and if I personally can't help you, I promise you a referral to somebody that you can trust to help you.
That's the end of part two of my interview with Michael Fishman. I hope this has been helpful. Make sure you listen to my other interviews on direct mail at hardtofindseminars.com. Look specifically for my interviews with Melvin Powers and also my interview with Ted Nicholas and my interview with Jim Straw, all direct mail icons in their own right. Thanks for listening.